Committee on Agricultural and Natural Resources for February 11th, 2003. Welcome to you all, and we will hear two bills today instead of three. I know we have three on the list. We have been requested that we step back a bit from hearing House Bill 2202. We will not hear that bill today. We will hear it soon, but not for the moment. So, with that, the chair would like to welcome the members of the committee. Good to see you all once again. And for those of you in the audience today, I would call your attention to once again, as I am wont to do at every committee hearing, that if you're signing up to share with us your thoughts, you need to take notice of, at the top of the sign-in sheet, the ORS is regarding truthful and accurate testimony. And as you sign this sheet, you hereby acknowledge that you have read and understand that. For members of the general public, if there are any here, this does not apply to you. It only applies to government officials and lobbyists. That doesn't mean, of course, that we want anyone to not give us accurate and truthful testimony. So, having said that, the first bill we're going to open up a public hearing on, once again, is House Bill 2188. Ray, any changes on 2188 so far?
No, Mr. Chair, I have no changes.
Okay, very good. The chair would like to call Norm Miller and Wally. You want to come at the same time? Yes. Okay. Gentlemen, welcome to you both, and for the record, state your names.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Norm Miller. I am the Timber Tax Operations Supervisor for the Department of Revenue, here to speak on House Bill 2188.
And I am Wallace Rutledge. I'm the Director of Forestry Assistance with the Department of Forestry.
Very good. Welcome to you both. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, would like to make this actually probably fairly brief for you and your committee. I do have a statement here. I might as well just read it, because that way I will be technically correct.
It's important to be technically correct. We appreciate that. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. House Bill 2188 was initially created to implement forest land taxation policies established by the 1999 and 2001 legislatures. Current statutes say that as of July 1 of 2003, all forest land owners are taxed at 100% of the statutory forest land value. They further say that the Western Oregon Privilege Tax and Eastern Oregon Privilege Tax rates would go to 0% as of January 1 of 2003. This bill carries the zero tax rate further in the elimination of the privilege tax by deleting the statutes that require such things as the annual creation of stumpage values for the privilege tax, the annual mailing of tax returns to taxpayers, and the annual filing of tax returns. Tax returns that would be filed under the current statutes at this point in time would net zero tax and create unnecessary work by the Department of Revenue and taxpayers both. So this bill, as it's currently written, does create some conflicts in terms of timing with provisions of House Bill 2197 that you heard a couple of weeks ago, and we recognize that. In light of this, the Department of Revenue will be proposing changes to House Bill 2188. Our desire is to wait to amend House Bill 2188 until after 2197 passes out of the Senate Revenue Committee. Waiting right now should shorten the amount of committee time required for hearing the bill, and we will be working with Legislative Council, the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, the Department of Forestry, and Oregon Forest Industries Council to change mainly as the implementation timings of House Bill 2188. Our goal is to make sure that these two bills work completely together. And right now, it's mainly a timing issue that we're dealing with.
So, okay, very good.
With that,
thank you, Norm. Hey there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm fine, thank you, and I'll just take a minute of your time to say that The reason I'm here is because there is a conflict with House Bill 2197. The Department of Forestry has agreed to work with the Department of Revenue and the constituents to work out those differences once 2197 passes through the House and the Senate, we hope. And then we'll come back with 2188 with the Department of Revenue and clean up some statutes that will make their job much easier. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Excellent. Question, Norm, as we move away from the old system and the obvious argument you've made in your prepared testimony regarding what would be a waste of effort and energy to send out tax returns for something that there's no tax for anymore, there's obviously some savings to your department in that regard, I would think. Now, will that be offset, do you think, by any new system or the system that 2197 creates?
Mr. Chair, when you consider the current staff that's administering the privileged tax and the other programs that we have, there will be some offset by House Bill 2197. There will be staffing required to set that particular program up and to maintain that program over time. This particular bill, House Bill 2188, since it does remove some of the privileged tax provisions, will have a fiscal impact that will amount in the reduction of at least two staff.
Okay, so we'll reduce two staff, but it's not going to take us two staff to administer the new program in 2197.
Right? Well, Mr. Chair, the net effect would be to reduce two staff.
Okay, very good. Okay, members? Hearing no questions, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Norm? Come forward. Sorry. By two staff, do you mean two FTE?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. That's two FTE.
Okay, great. Thank you for that clarification. Appreciate it. Any additional thoughts, members? Is there anyone else here who wants to testify on 2188 currently? Hearing none, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2188. And Vice Chair Wirth, we're not going to hear 2202 today. We will hear 2203. So we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2203. Ray, you want to share with us what this bill does?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2203 defines the actual cost of certain fire abatement activities. It restricts challenges by owners or operators and actions for cost recovery to questioning account practices and procedures. It prohibits a court from reviewing a discretionary decision of a forester or forest protective agency, association or agency, to incur actual cost in controlling or extinguishing a fire. It declares an emergency effective on passage. And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, if you take a look at the background, that needs to be rewritten. So I will be taking care of that after this hearing.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Ray. And we have a sign-up sheet. We have three individuals that will testify together. Charlie Stone, Pete, how do I say it? I'm sorry.
Narkovic.
Okay, that sounds like a good Norwegian name. And Bill, come forward if you would, please.
Thanks.
Welcome to you all. For the record, state your names and tell us why we're doing this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Charlie Stone. I'm the Assistant State Forester for the Department of Forestry's Protection Division. And on my immediate right is Pete Narkovic. Pete is our lead investigator and does all the cost recovery actions for the department. And on my far right is Bill Bricky of the Department of Justice, the lead attorney in charge for the civil recovery section. I'm going to be very brief. Let me first say thank you, Mr. Chair, for postponing House Bill 2202. We'll try to move as quickly as we can to bring parties together and let Ray know when how things are coming along on that.
Thank you.
House Bill 2203 is a bill that we believe clarifies what we believe has always been the legislative intent, that when the state forester takes fire suppression actions and someone has been negligent or willful or is otherwise responsible for the cause of that fire and has a responsibility to pay, that the actual costs of that suppression action not be challenged on the basis of the decisions that the firefighters and the forester have to make as they're going, only on the, you know, that it's an accurate billing, that they pay the actual costs as per the law. And I'll let Pete and Bill talk more about the details, and then we'll all be available for answering questions.
Very good. Welcome.
Thank you.
For the record, state your name.
For the record, my name is Pete Narkovic. I'm the Legal Services Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Forestry, stationed here in Salem. And as Charlie has said, we support House Bill 2203. This clarifies actual cost in ORS 477.068, which is basically our section of law which enables us to recover costs. It gives us a set of procedures to accomplish that. Very simply, the actual cost is the certified cost of the forester's actions when they fight a uncontrolled fire. And actual cost is used by the forester in recovery of the suppression costs when a party, through the course of an investigation, is deemed by those facts negligent in the origin or the subsequent spread of that fire. Cost recovery actions replace upwards of $1 million each year back into the firefighting budgets across the state. This is very significant. The decisions made by the forester during a fire emergency translate into cost. The forester must weigh many variables in a condensed time frame. Incident commanders rely on discipline, training, and experience to make these decisions. This is an extraordinary responsibility by any measure. The risks are always high and the potential consequences are great. The incident unfolds rapidly and changes frequently. Most decisions are made within seconds or minutes and must consider such variables as safety for citizens and firefighters, resource cost and availability, terrain and fire behavior, various values at risk. The list actually goes on and varies from incident to incident and changes from moment to moment. At the end of the day, the forester has met the statutory obligation to protect life, resource, and property. The cost for such an action is tallied and included in any subrogation action if liability exists. The challenges raised against the necessity of a fire action has ballooned our legal costs and confused juries even when responsible parties admit their liability. The cost not recovered from liable parties is borne by landowners that did not cause the problem but are paying for fire protection nevertheless. It is our position that the legislature intended to preserve actual costs and recognize the discretionary nature of the foresters acting under such emergencies. At this point, what I'd like to do is defer to my colleague, Mr. Bill Brickey of the Oregon Department of Justice, to reflect on how this translate those legal challenges translate into the problem that we experience. And again, thank you for this opportunity to testify today, and I'd be available to answer questions after Bill is complete.
Thank you, Pete. Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the panel. I'm Bill Brickey. I'm with the Oregon Department of Justice, as you know. I'm a trial lawyer, and we left the trial division just within a year, and I've now been the civil recovery section. We're the plaintiff's attorneys for the state of Oregon. We seek to recover money the taxpayers have paid in or expended. We try to get it back when we can. I'm not going to read my letter. I don't think that's necessary. I believe less is more, and I've done far better in my career when I say that. I'm going to point just two or three very concrete examples. The last major lawsuit we had in Central Eastern Oregon, the defense attorney spent 3 days cross-examining my incident commanders. They pinned them down and had each one of them second-guess the other commander. You have to be there to see it. Defense lawyers are very smart. They're very bright. They're well-educated. And they have experts who are also people knowledgeable in this business who do the very same thing. And what they did, they studied our records. And Pete Narkovic was there. He will tell you that we had to explain the use of aircraft, the Grayback Forestry firefighters that we called and recalled and sent back out because of the dynamic conditions of the fire. this increased our cost at least twice, just going through those depositions, because it's a fertile field. We change incident commanders every 12 hours. Those of you that may have already worked in the fire business know, and we replace the crews as frequently as we can. And these men and women work 24 hours a day, around the clock, 6, 7, 10 days at a time. The bulldozers are on site. The aircraft fly in the dark. The point is, it's a dangerous, hazardous business that's easy to second guess. In simple terms, we support this very strongly. You'll be doing a favor to these gentlemen on the field, because when I get it or when my staff gets this, it's done. We can't go back. It's all there. The actual costs remain. The juries are confused. The judges are sympathetic because the defense attorney says, is it reasonable, Mr. Jones or Mr. Norkovec, that you kept that aircraft in the air for 8 hours when you only needed it for six? And at $800 an hour, that's $1,600. We end up measuring what it is we've done. And all I could say to you, you got to believe me, the costs are already there. We've already spent it. It's not like I can go back and undo it. And the people that pay for it are the other landowners who didn't cause the fire. So I would urge you to pass this bill. And I'll answer any questions you may have.
Members, do we have questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bricky, I believe?
Yes.
Mr. Norkovec?
Yes.
And Mr. Stone, thank you for being here. Could you give, Mr. Chair, thank you. Could you give us some specific examples of where this has happened on here in Oregon so we could best understand it, please?
You mean you want specific facts of how it took? I think our schoolhouse gulch fire was the last one I was associated with, where we brought in all of our incident commanders and those who were responsible, the people that made the decisions, and they sat through depositions for 3 days. They were handed the documents, which are the tracking sheets for the various information that we generate, and asked to explain why they didn't call the bulldozers an hour earlier, why they didn't call off the 20-man firefighting team that was left on the ridge overnight and brought them out in the morning. Why didn't they bring them out that night? Those are the questions that I, as specific as I can say, and I can bring the, I don't want to bore you with the depositions because they're this thick for this amount of information, but you know how attorneys can expand that quickly. And that's what happened. What the reason that I feel strongly about this is I found my incident commanders were having to second guess the previous incident commander. That's where they went to work.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr.
Yes, Kevin. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Bricky. What I was just curious of, you know, is this the only area of disaster relief that does this? I mean, if a state police calls six more cars, I mean, we don't charge that expense to that house. I mean, we assume they knew what they were doing, and we're exercising prudent judgment.
Right. Now I understand your question. I'm sorry. I probably didn't understand.
That's okay.
Well, first of all, I'm not aware of any recovery we can make for the state police, you know, regretfully when they do that. But, yes, the fire has happened. We know that. The defense attorney admits that. We know that the fire was call or either controlled or extinguished. We can show that. We know we were there. We've got the people to prove that. The question is how much money should they repay to us? And so if they can cut their bill by $200,000, because some of these fires go over $1 million,
sure,
then it's the attorney has made his fee, the insurance carrier has made their money, and they've saved that much money. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's...
Thank you. Follow up,
yes.
And, please. In the event that the landowner, you know, does not have an insurance, doesn't carry a policy, who's going to pay for that bad debt?
Okay. Now, first of all, I don't worry about that. We find the responsible parties. But to answer your question, we would sue the landowner if they were negligent or willfully started the fire or were responsible for it. Most of these are operations conducted by professionals. There are people working in the forest areas or in the agricultural areas. These are corporations that do this for a living. I'm sure we have some. In fact, I know we do who are individuals. But these are forest operations, and one we've got coming up here set for trial is just that.
Well, I was wondering, Mr. Chair, if there is a requirement for them to carry insurance.
Yes.
Landowners who would be protected by you, so there is a way for you to be compensated for
that's
your...
That's the reason we do it.
Okay.
I didn't mean to overrun you, but that's right. That's exactly...
Do you have some thoughts to add?
Yes. Chair Krupp, Representative Nelson, I believe that what might help with this is kind of to reflect on the types of cases that we have. We have 200 or 300 cases every year. And I stated that sometimes this represents $1 million plus in terms of business of recovering funds. I would have to say that out of those cases, 99% of the time, there is an insurance mechanism in place that has protected landowners, businesses, individuals, ranches, and so forth that is playing out here. It is a rare circumstance that it becomes the personal assets of the individual, their property, and so forth, that is subject to the claim. However, there is a provision in law for that. It is seldom visited in these matters. I might also address one of your previous concerns in terms of the use of resources. Often there are resources that respond to an incident but are not actually used in the fire action. This is kind of reflect your example of the state police cars. Those are not included in our actual cost. They have to actually be used in the fire action right. to be considered actual cost. So that's what we're up against is that scrutiny on what is actually used, not what is actually might be put in standby or in a state of readiness nearby.
Correct. Okay, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Krupp. I don't even know where to begin. Can you give me an example of the willful, malicious, or negligence on the landowner that you're writing this bill for?
I haven't filed any that I can recall of any willful. I find grossly negligent.
Could you give me an example?
Sure. Starting a fire in a barrel in the middle of August, and the fields around were all dry of grain and left the barrel, and the stuff blew out and it went to 1,000 acres in the space of a few hours. Running a bulldozer with unprotected. The pads were not protected, and they were throwing off hot metal and sparks, welding, the trains. I don't mean to point at anyone, but anyone using heavy machinery in dry areas and not protecting or fire suppressing their exhaust.
Follow up?
Yes.
Can you tell me what the ORS 477066 requires?
Yes, that allows the state to recover its actual costs in recovering, and we need to show that there was a fire and that it was either willful or negligently caused, and the responsible person was engaged in some operation in the area. It's a little more than that, but that's the best I can do without having. I don't have it. Well, I might have it in front.
Well, that's okay. I can look it up.
Pete, you have a comment also?
Yes, Chair Krupp and Representative Smith, to give you some examples of willful, malicious, and negligent. A clean example of willful is an act of arson. Somebody who willfully causes damage or harm would also be liable, not only subject to criminal law, but the civil. Responsibilities of that liability. Malicious would be an act of malfeasance, somebody that is hostile or just out of control, usually related to a human behavior that results in a fire. Sometimes reckless partygoers and reckless vehicle use and so forth is malicious in nature. It's those types of human actions. And negligence is a failure to act prudently, and a lot of times that ties into our fire prevention requirements, that if you fail a fire prevention requirement and results in one of these uncontrolled fires, that requirement was in place to prevent that fire. If you didn't have the right equipment, if you didn't properly trail or put fire breaks around something you were burning, you didn't monitor it, left the fire unattended, and so forth, that's a lack of prudent action, lack of prudent care based on what a reasonable person would do in that same circumstance. And so that's how we look at willful, malicious, and negligent.
Thank you. I'll think about it a minute.
Okay.
Thank you.
We have lots of time.
That's okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
The am I correct in understanding that the reason that there's no additional revenue expected is because that would be passed on to the local fire districts? Any savings that you would accumulate through this procedure would just be passed through to reduce costs of local districts.
The recoveries, Chair Krupp and Representative Hunt, the recoveries through cost recovery as it relates to fire liability, those funds are directly returned back to the budgets whether they're in red ink or black ink, they go back to those budgets. We're hoping we can put black ink back on the books. That's our job. And they not only go to they don't go to it in a general sense, they go to the actual district budget in that area. So they actually affect those immediate landowners that pay for fire protection in that area. They also feed back into the emergency fire fund. And our objective is to contribute to keeping that those sources solvent.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, to add to that, I think that the consideration of not having a fiscal impact is that we don't really believe that this this bill changes anything in the way that the law should be interpreted currently. It's a matter of making more clear what we believe has always been intended. And so if that's true, what we've been collecting is what we will still collect. And, of course, that goes up and down for each year depending on the fires and the causes. So from that standpoint, there's no way to determine any actual fiscal impact. It doesn't change our budgets or the number of people that we employ in the efforts.
That actually is a good segue to my follow-up, which was if this is going to reduce some of the litigious activity that you all are forced to spend staff time absorbing, I guess help me understand how that wouldn't be some cost savings, at least to your department. I understand how it's not net revenue for your department, but how would it not be cost savings, at least to some degree?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, we hope that it will be, but there's no way for us to be able to predict what that would be from 1 year to the next.
Now you said that you've had, I believe, 2 to 3 of these lawsuits per year. Is that correct?
Yes. When I say that, I'm very mindful it depends upon how many we don't settle or recover without litigation. That's where the key starts. I don't want to misrepresent. There are far more fires than we file upon.
Right.
The ones that we get are the hard ones, the tough ones, where the firefighting apparatus, where the cause was moved before the fire broke out. And when it actually starts, there's no one there. Or where the operation is, quote, ended, or something else has happened. The logging operation's moving out. There's a smoldering fire left. There was the one arson I thought about, and I regret, Representative Smith, I should have answered that. Mr. Norkovec himself directly was involved. He got the perpetrator, but those are rare, and we don't file on those because the carrier on those are the people involved. Usually, at least we haven't had to file on those. But I'm afraid to tell you 2 or 3 a year. I can tell you how many we have pending right now. I think we got about 7. But depends. We settle. We just recently settled one down in Eugene out of that area. We mediate these.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I might add to that although we might say to you 2 or 3 a year, often those are 2 or 3 of our most significant cost fires that are out there. They often measure in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions. And by numbers, there's a great number of fires that are a few hundred dollars or thereabouts. And there's probably not an issue. This matter is not an issue in those types of cases. But when the stakes are high and it's worth legal intervention on both sides to protect interests, that's when we have these problems. So those 2 or 3 cases a year are usually our biggest cases and our greatest dollars at risk.
Makes sense. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple thoughts. Now, I'm assuming when y'all are saying we, you're including us subcontractors, the providers of the helicopter service for you. Are you including us?
We keep track of all the costs. Maybe Pete would better answer this, but I'm given a printout. By the time it gets to us, we know what's been spent. And you are right, Representative. Those include the firefighters and all the subs and the costs that go into bringing them in. Yes.
But that printout is only the actual cost of people who actually were involved
correct.
In the action.
Correct. And the
not people on standby.
Correct. That is correct.
Unless, Mr. Chair,
yes.
I hope, unless you're contracted to be on standby, which we were. I mean, we stood by for 35 years.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, there are circumstances that the condition of standby is very close to the incident. It's more like a staging, and it's likely it will be used on that incident. There are obligations of payment to those contractors and so forth. What I'm talking about is resources that are in a state of readiness, usually some distance away.
Not in that location.
But not in that location. And again, when we have this tally of lists, those contractors have already been paid and compensated for this. So at this stage of the game, we're representing the interests of those who pay for fire protection, because the bill's already been paid. We're trying to get a percentage or all of it back.
And
yes.
Last question. I don't even want to talk about fires caused by acts of God and how you fail him for this extra required service. As we're looking at tort liability for in the medical world right now, do we have any laws that limit your collection ability?
You mean, are there any statutes? I don't mean to overrun again. You mean, are there any statutory limits on the recovery? No.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, with one exception, that when a landowner engages in an operation or burning and a fire escapes and they are not willful, malicious, or negligent, there is a statutory liability for the extra costs, and those are for the costs beyond the normal budgeted costs of that district. And that is capped at $300,000. But that is like we call it statutory, it's like a strict liability for those extra costs. And really, there's only two things we have to establish for that circumstance. One is that the fire occurred in the operation area, and two, that the fire was the result of that operation. If those two circumstances exist, there is a limited liability, but almost a strict liability for those extra costs up to $300,000. It takes a little explanation. It's a complicated formula, but it's been longstanding and used frequently.
And Representative, the chances are we would never see that. DOJ would not see that. The one we see are the big ones where it's worth $200,000 to $300,000 to an insurance carrier to reduce. To cut it, we spend $2 or $3 million in fighting, and if they can save 10%, you get an idea of what the recovery is. So.
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Chair.
Did you want to add something else, Charlie? I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, just though Representative Nelson wasn't going to get into acts of God, I think maybe it'd be well to point out that many, many of the fires that we suppress, there isn't a responsible party, either because of lightning or because the fire occurred. There, we don't find negligence, whatever. Those folks have paid an assessment to the state forester for fire protection along with the general fund, and we take the suppression costs out of that budgeted money. And they never hear from us again. So there are a number of fires that we don't have any cost collection to go back on, and that's part of the routine of the business.
Mrs. Smith?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for your information. I just have a does this work in reverse, where are you guys held liable if your fire gets out of control and gets on fire by enforcement?
I mean, is the state of Oregon liable if the state
if state managed land burns onto private?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, yes, the state land is liable just like any other landowner. They pay the state forests pay their forest patrol assessment actually at double the amount that the private landowners do. The private landowners have a 50-50 match with the general fund. Government landowners pay the full freight, whether it's BLM or state forests or some of the smaller Bureau of Reclamation, that type of thing. So they pay for their fire protection, and if they're negligent in the origin or hopefully not willful, but if they're negligent in the escape of a slash burn or something like that, they're liable for costs. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
But if I could just add one thing, we will be putting that fire out.
Right.
In other words, the private won't have their own fire suppression. That will come to us to control and fight too. If that makes sense. In other words, this same organization will be suppressing the fire.
Right. I bring that up, Chair, because the Multnomah Falls Fire in 1991 burned onto private timberland, and everything was controlled by the Department of Forestry. And so the landowner had no say in how everything was managed, and yet it burned onto the property, and yet they were told what to do with it. So it was kind of a complicated issue, so that's why I asked that.
And Chair Krupp, Representative Smith, I believe that fire that you talk about started actually on National Forest land, and I couldn't tell you for sure what their liability is in terms of the federal protections and law. But
I can tell you it was none.
And I'm not surprised that it certainly would at least be difficult to try and recover costs from. There have been occasions where recovery has taken place for damages to private land.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. How much money have you spent in court costs at the DOJ, say, in the last couple of years?
I can't give you an accurate answer. I can tell you that we'll spend $30,000 to $40,000 prosecuting a fire case, and we will spend another $20,000 if we are then forced into this situation where we've got to defend every single decision made starting at 001, which was the first time the fire was spent. $30,000 to $40,000, Mr. Chairman, is my best estimate, bearing in mind that we get a lot less than that on many fires once they see we're there and we mean business. In other words, the carriers come through, and Mr. Norkovec will tell you that we mediate in addition to litigate. In other words, that's part of the business.
Right, but again, to clarify here, is that you're talking about two or three cases per year that go to trial beyond mediation, correct?
Mr. Chair, it does not exclude those cases that get bogged down with additional legal costs that never go to trial. They allege fire action or necessity arguments or allegations, and it really protracts our preparations, review, and potential settlement. They're trying to posture and get us into a position of reduced settlement. And so it does, outside of those two or three cases that end up in the courtroom, there probably are at least 10 to a dozen cases that fall in that category I just mentioned. I might, by example, give you a cite a couple of cases. One is the Street Canyon case. The other is the Schoolhouse Gulch case. And in each of those, we encumbered about $50,000 in legal costs when the parties admittedly stipulated that they were liable, and that costs us still $50,000 in legal expense because of this issue. And specifically on the Street Canyon, the jury, in my opinion, and there, I may stand corrected, but I stood through the whole trial, it was my opinion that the jury was so confused that they reduced the settlement, the actual judgment, from the full amount, and they reduced it by 60%. Now, the landowners that aren't responsible for this problem are left holding the bag, and that's what probably bothers me as an administrator trying to do the job I've been hired to do. It's very frustrating when we think the law means something else, and we end up with a different result.
Yeah, indeed. So, again, to look at the language of this bill, on page 2 of the printed bill on sub 6, starting in line 7, when you get to line 8, it says, may challenge only the accounting practices and procedures. So the way I'm reading this in your testimony is, and the SMS prepared by staff, is that the ability to challenge your accounting practices and procedures still will be in place if we pass this legislation. But that seems to be, from your testimony, frankly, the heart of your problem.
No. Okay. I don't want to argue with you. The heart of the problem is the discretionary decisions.
Okay.
The heart of the problem is when you bring a 20-man unit in, firefighters, stage them, move them in, put them in the area, and then withdraw them 3 hours later because something has changed. Either the fire's turned, we feel they're in danger, we ship them out. We bill that, we pay for that whole thing, but the work they do compared to a 20-person unit that's there for 6 or 8 hours. In other words, we still pay the bill, but they've really not done much work. And that's where the challenge goes. Was it reasonable to move those men in or those people and move them out?
So you're saying then, Bill, that a defense attorney could not come in and utilize the same arguments to challenge your accounting practices.
That's correct, because that is a mechanical or mathematical procedural matter. For example, are we paying fair market value? That is a practice. Yes, we are. We have to pay what we sign up for. I don't know, I probably didn't present this really clearly, but the question becomes whether the decision to call in the aircraft, or as we had bulldozers lined up to go, is that a good decision based on what you knew at the time? And the answer is, it's my best decision at the time. And the flip side of the argument is, when the fires really start, we only have a certain limited amount of resource to draw upon. And we cannot get the retardant up into the hills. Fires go uphills, the wind will push them, they go faster uphill. Sometimes when they do downhill, they'll burn in hot spots. So retardant can work, but we can't always get it there. The question is, at least the cross-examination always goes to the issue, is your decision, Mr. Jones, was to, and then they state it, why didn't you call back or recall or put back or withdraw?
And this legislation will stop that practice of questioning the judgment of the fire incident commander at the time.
Right.
But it still allows them to challenge, were you paying fair market value for the retardant drop? Was it reasonable?
Correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Okay.
Which
Dr.
I think is
Nelson?
Only fair. I mean, that's only fair.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, thank you, Mr. Krupp. I can identify with this, having been involved for, so many years, fighting fires for y'all and many other states and nations. For example, these are the things that I'm curious about. I'll just use this one example because it's close to our hearts right now. For example, fighting Desert Storm, the only refinery was in Kuwait, so you had to bill the government for getting fuel in Turkey because you, of course, couldn't go into Kuwait. Now, that could be a real issue in fighting fire for us subcontractors who, have to get fuel and we can't get it in the location where we are. So I'm assuming this is, or there's reciprocity, so your subcontractors, you will include their total costs as you present this bill to the landowner.
The actual cost, Representative Nelson, is there, and that we pay that bill.
And does that allow the subcontractor to make a profit, Mr. Chair?
We don't, to my knowledge, now Pete can correct this, but I do not know of a single instance when we have challenged the bill that's come in. Okay. Now, maybe there are some, when I see it, it's there. It's printed, and this is the amount.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just to be extra clear on that, I think the process is we fight the fire. We've contracted with folks like Representative Nelson's company and others to provide a service. We pay them what we agreed to pay them, for whatever their costs are. And then after that's all done with, the timing may or may not be. I suppose it could overlap if Pete was real quick one day, would be to say, okay, what were our costs of the fire? And it was appropriate. It was the action on the fire. We bill that to the responsible party. What we're trying to say here in this bill is that if the bill adds up right, if the accounting procedures are correct, it adds up right based on those things that we actually already paid to Representative Nelson's company, that's what we should be reimbursed.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, just one last follow-up. I can understand where this could happen many times with different landowners. How are you going to divide that up? As I'm in the fire in Jeffs County and it's gone into Yamhill County, there's this positioning back and forth. And so, that positioning and that is always a question. Who gets charged for it? The ranch you're leaving or the ranch you're going to?
Now, that's a separate issue. That's
but I'm
not
just saying, when you're billing these landowners, I'm sure that's part of the...
You're talking about the assessment part. Yeah, that's okay.
That is probably going to always be a question of debate, and I don't know how you cure that one.
Pete?
I'm not going to come close to trying.
Okay.
It's an integral part of our system, of which landowners contribute through fire patrol assessments, as contributions of general fund and so forth, that add up to a resource being there for fire protection. And when a fire travels across the landscape, absent anyone being liable for having caused the ignition or the spread of a fire, then we all agree in the holistic system of wherever that fire goes, we're all going to pay for it. We're all going to help each other out. We're going to put it out the best way we can. We're going to pay all our bills, and we're going to work hard, and we're going to work safely. When there is, however, a culpable party, then the strategy changes to looking at that replacement based on those actions back into the funds so the innocent parties aren't adversely impacted.
What's it worth?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, can you explain to me the difference? I understand that what we're saying here is we're trying to prohibit a court from reducing the cost that the owner is liable for when that cost is connected to a discretionary decision by the forester or forest protective association, public agency. So we want to prohibit the court from saying it's in the court's judgment, you know, the discretionary decision was wrong. How does that differ from, because the bill also says, in such an action, a court may not review the factual determination of, nor substitute its judgment for. Well, can you tell me exactly what the factual determination of, what we're prohibiting the court from doing in that phrase?
I would approach it one of three ways. I can answer or try to answer that by a factual circumstance on the Schoolhouse Gulch, where our first incident commander, who's on the scene within an hour of the fire, left the scene, went down, and went to another ridge to look. He wanted to see where it was going because it's wild country, and the aircraft weren't there yet. Went back. The fact that he left that scene and drove to another vantage point was challenged strongly by the attorneys, that he was not doing his job. What we want to say is, whose judgment is it, the court, the judge's judgment, who allows that in, or the defense attorney, or even me, who says to Mr. Chairman Kropp, when you're on that fire scene, you have to stay in that one place. So that's the factual circumstance that we try to prevent being re-litigated. It's his decision to go to that other area and take an hour, however long it took him, then to come back. That's one of my responses. Second response is, his decision, which he didn't call in, and he had BLM material he could have called, which was closer to the site, but he chose to call another group. I think that's correct. I think it was BLM, but I may not be right, but I think it was the federal resources. That was questioned. Why didn't he call them? They were closer. The reason was they were larger. It was harder to get them there. They had larger equipment, and there were some other restrictions on it. So he picked smaller equipment to get to the site, and Representative Nelson's nodding because she understands what I'm saying. I myself don't know the difference what that is. That is another decision. We do not want that decision challenged as to whether it was right or wrong, because the difference in money obviously comes out. I'm not sure what the difference is, but there is a difference. And the third thing is, he goes off, the first incident commander has left the scene. He's now gone. He's been there 12 hours and he's tired, or she. The next person comes in, it's dark. He or she revokes what's happened before, moves people, withdraws people down, and that leads to the implication they weren't needed, that the first one put them there unnecessarily, if that makes sense to you all. Mm-hmm. Now, you're nodding, and I'm telling you, 12 jurors are not going to get that detailed explanation that I've just given you. They will see the cross-examination of where the witness says, well, I decided to bring that 20-man unit down to the base and send them around, which meant they weren't needed there. Well, that was put there by the first commander.
Okay.
Yes.
So, can you tell me, I mean, in the worst case scenario, wouldn't passing this legislation, however, protect a court from reducing the cost that the owner is liable for if in the case of a discretionary decision that's just blatantly, clearly wrong.
Okay, and I'm going to ask you a question now. This is not meant to be offensive. According to whose standards?
Well,
according to the
yes.
According to the person on the ground, or according to the judge, or the jury, or
wouldn't that be beyond any question? I mean, would there say every state forester in the state looked at that decision and thought, yeah, the guy was a little off kilter there, and that was a wrong decision. However, because of this statute, would it now be beyond any question that that discretionary decision was, in fact, beyond challenge?
Now, when you phrase it that way, the answer is no. If we're in the wrong section, fighting the wrong fire, or we're not fighting the fire, we do something, I'm trying to think of some, we pour gasoline out, trying to think of some reason, you know, that's clearly wrong, that none of you would dare say is reasonable, then that would probably not be, I don't think any judge that I know of would allow that to go forward.
Okay,
I don't know.
And I don't mean to go that blatantly. Sure. I don't think there's any state forester who would pour gasoline on
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
But it clearly made a decision in error that
sure.
that increased the costs, you know, prohibitively. That a more seasoned, say, state
sure.
forester would not, or, you know, in agreement that
sure.
that was not the best choice, and therefore increased the costs dramatically. Would that now be beyond any challenge?
I would say yes. Based on the way this is worded, the answer to your question is yes. And if I were the defense lawyer, I would ask for a hearing for the court under the rule. With the jury not present, I would put in testimony to show that the man was intoxicated, or she or he, doesn't make any difference to me who it was, and or made a decision that left people exposed in that area, causing dramatic cost, you see. And I'm thinking about that Colorado fire where the firefighters were killed. I know you remember when they put them there. There's no question, and that's not meant to cast fault, but that was a federal firefighting operation, and they did make a bad decision. The question is, it's like a police officer that shoots the fellow with a flashlight when he thinks he's holding a weapon.
Right.
You're substituting your judgment that time for that person. We're trying to stop that. So the answer is, I would argue that this bill does prevent them from going right into the very issue you've raised. Yes, and if I were the state's attorney, I would say to the court, Your Honor, you're not allowed to allow this testimony. I sure would. And I would protect it and take it up, even though, as you say, it's clearly wrong. That means our people made the decision at the time, unless it was malicious, trying to think, you know, how that would be. So I'd have to back our forester at that point.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Nelson? Oh, excuse me, Charlie, do you want to add something?
To follow up on that, yes, and I may have Pete check me on this, but I think there's two pieces to that question. One of them, first of all, if everybody else in the department agrees that it's a problem, I believe that we still have the ability, before we present the bill, to adjust it. I mean, if we had costs that on retrospect weren't appropriate costs, we don't have to bill that to the responsible party, and would hope that if it was recognized internally that we'd take that action. But almost in argument against that, the flip side of that is the money's already been spent, and it goes against the rest of the landowners in the district if it isn't paid for by the responsible party for the fire. So it's still a matter of do you bill it to the person that caused the fire and that has responsibility, or do you bill it to the other landowners who had no responsibility for it? The money's already been spent. There's no taking back the error. And so either way, I think we would try to recognize our failures. Hopefully they're few. But at the same time, once there's a cause for the fire and there's a responsible party, this bill puts that cost on that party rather than on all the landowners shared.
Pete.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wirth, I think one thing that might contribute to a comfort level with this is every incident is investigated very thoroughly by professionally trained and certified investigators. Once the facts support the standards of liability where we would make demand on somebody after verifying the actual cause. In their first demand and two other reminder demand notices, they are invited to submit information to our agency to mitigate the situation. This occurs over a 90-day process. In fact, 477068 prescribes that. And during that process, if these issues do come up,
They come up in a variety of ways. Sometimes they provide us private investigations. Sometimes they file a tort action against the state. Sometimes they just call us and want to talk about it. It comes to us in a variety of ways. We open a subsequent investigation into those elements that they've brought forward. If there's anything that suggests that we need to adjust or forgive a certain situation, and it occasionally happens, we're all human beings, then we take those actions, preferably before taking any kind of cost recovery action. And that's my job, and I'm almost a stickler on that to a fault. And the people in the agency can tell you how particular I am about that. And once we get to the situation we're talking about here today with these actual costs and in the courtroom, usually those issues are far behind us and been resolved. A lot of them come out of just confusion or misunderstandings or miscommunications or lack of information. We deal with that before we get into these court actions or get into the serious legal actions to recover costs.
I just might add, I don't want to mislead you in any way, Representative Worth. Once it comes to me, that is the certified actual cost.
Okay.
In other words, when I get it, as right. Pete tells you and Charlie, that we work with that. That's what the lawyers do.
Right.
That's what they've said. That's what they've certified. And what's behind that is what you've raised. They will have resolved that, and as I said, I didn't mean to overstate that, but I will go for the actual cost. We will file for those. That's what the statute says. That's what we go, because that's what the landowners paid.
Right.
Okay. They're a party to this thing, too, and that's how we treat it as a trust at DOJ. We look at that as public money that's ours to take care of. And I regret that there are mistakes, and I'm sure there are going to be many, but still, we feel a responsible party, when he or she undertakes this action, pays that bill. It has to be paid. Someone's got to pay it. Who should pay the bill? The one causing it or the people in the district? Don't know if that helps you, but that's sort of an attitude. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, and Mr. Chair. Having experienced this in our last Ag Committee, I just want to be sure this is not the case. I noticed this takes effect immediately. And that begins. This will relate to any fire after the date of the bill. There's no retroactivity to this.
Okay, first of all,
that rescinds any other court award, I hope.
Yeah. Representative Nelson, that's one of the greatest legal issues for all lawyers to earn great livings on. Is ex post facto, or when does it take effect? Does it take effect on the date? Does it apply to those that are pending? Does it apply to those that fires? Frankly, I haven't looked at this for that matter. I would say it probably applies only to fires that occur after the date you enact it. That'd be my best guess. That'd be the safest. If you try something other than that, then you won't save any money.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm assuming that's going to come in the administrative rule, what do you have?
Right.
I don't know in this case, but because it is not in here.
Right. I will tell you right now, I wouldn't go any other way. Okay. I would say from fires, Representative Chairman, after, because once you get into that gray area full of litigation, my gosh, no, then we don't save anything. No.
So are you saying that you need to clarify the language of this bill?
Well, I would think it's, unless there's some enabling statute that automatically does that, I would think your bill is good the way it is, because it applies prospectively. It doesn't apply backwards. That's my take. Now, the trouble with me is I'm not a general counsel, and you've already noticed they used to say, come over to the trial division, we'll give you an opinion immediately, and it might be wrong, but you'll get one. You go to general counsel, they'll study it and discuss it and, you know, debate it. We don't do that. But my reaction is the bill is good the way it is.
Mr. Chair, far be it for me to argue with counsel here. I think maybe it'd be wise to check with legislative counsel, because I can. What occurs to me is that we do have cases pending, and while the fire has already occurred, the court action hasn't. And the way I read it, I would think that this would apply to any of those court actions after the passage of the bill. So maybe we ought to get clarification before we move.
I think that would be a good thing, and I think we'll. We'll do that before we.
I would agree with that too. I really would. I would agree with that.
That's better to have that. Who's not going to like this?
Oh boy, I'm not sure I should even try, because I'm not sure. That's asking me my own personal opinion. I would think any carrier who feels, as Representative Worth has raised, that we're not doing the collective we, are not doing our job, that's who will not like this legislation. I think the intent, though, Mr. Chairman, of the first bill was to get the actual cost and to avoid the discretionary issues, if that balances it out.
I would assume that judges probably won't like it either.
I can't speak to that. I really don't know. Judges are pretty good. I mean, most judges are very reasonable. They just try and be fair to both parties. And that's where the trouble starts. It says, is it reasonable, Mr. Jones, to do what you did? And, you know, that hits a chord with all of us. We're all in the same boat. Every time you get a bill, you want to make sure it's reasonable. And that's how it gets started.
Now, would there be landowners that wouldn't like this also?
I'd have to let Pete and Charlie answer that.
Mr. Chair, I think we'll probably hear from the representatives of some of the landowner organizations, and my expectation is that they'll be supportive, but it probably depends on what chair you're sitting in at the time. The landowner who has had a fire and may be liable may not like it, but by and large, as a community, they're all being protected as a group, and the costs that aren't given to the responsible party come back to the whole, so I would expect them to support it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, can I just...
Yes.
I want to just quibble about one point. I certainly did not infer that I felt that the Forestry Department or anyone involved in state fire protection efforts are not doing their job. I'm trying to look at the worst-case possible scenario and look at it from every point of view. So I apologize if I gave that inference at all, because, I mean, I certainly don't want to be out doing your jobs. So.
Well, Representative Worth, I hope I didn't convey any impression, because you did not in any way, because I make decisions daily, and I've made several here today, frankly, you know, that I have to live with. So the answer is we're so used to that this discretionary. You do the very same thing every day in your business dealings right here. You'll make decisions that you would not like a group to come in next week and study and say. But my personal reaction is you conveyed no such impression. I hope I didn't reinforce that in any way. I didn't mean to.
We're all fine. Good.
Okay. Very good. No further questions being seen. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
Your patience.
Thank you very much.
Chair, I'd like to call Mike Dykesel. Did I say that correct?
That's pretty good.
You printed it well, from the Oregon Forest Industries Council. Welcome, Mike. Good to see you. And for the record, state your name, please.
Thank you, Chair Krupp and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Dykesel. It's D-Y-K-Z-E-U-L. I'm the Director of Forest Protection for the Oregon Forest Industries Council here in Salem. So I think I'm the designated representative of the landowner community that we were just referring to. And I guess I would concur with everything on the expert panel's discussion. I think they articulated the problem, the situation, the ramifications of the decision of this particular bill. I'd like to let you know that OFIC and our members are in support of it as written. I think the one question that has been raised, whether it's retroactive or not, should be addressed. Representative Worth, I almost sensed that the feeling that the decisions are being made by the incident commanders are all on behalf of the Oregon Department of Forestry, and I'd just like to share with the group the amount of oversight that takes place between the landowner community and the Oregon Department of Forestry. There are 12 forest protection districts around the state, in every corner of the state. Each one is governed by a board of directors of landowners that establish the level of protection in their district budgets, what is appropriate, what is not, what's the level of aggressiveness. Ultimately is the protection of natural resources, and it's a very unique system that everyone knows what the expectations of the department, what the contributions of the landowners within those districts can provide to minimize resource loss, to protect costs. So there is an awful lot of oversight that takes place, and with the escalating cost of fire protection over the last 7-8 years or longer, I can assure you that the incident management team's training in the spring very, very much in depth looks at cost of providing a level of protection. They're very cost conscious, but also for the protection of the resources and safety of the firefighters and the public out there. So you have one level of oversight that kind of governs the types of things that are done or assigned or brought to bear on a fire. The other oversight is Mr. Tom Lane is the administrator of the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund that also governs and takes a fine-tooth comb through the costs that are spent in the emergency fire cost program. So there is a fair amount of oversight expectations still with resource protection and public safety as the bottom line in that. So I just would like to share that with you, that there is some additional oversight, an awful lot of interaction and abilities and understanding between the department personnel on a district basis and the local landowners that they serve. And those costs that we're talking about was very articulately stated that is borne by the rest of the district people. And so if we can recover that from the guilty parties, that's fine in our book. So we would support it as written with that minor clarification.
Okay. Members, question? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure that you're going to appreciate this question, maybe the other panel, but I'm just curious of how far in the hole we are as far as the, you know, fighting fires of what, you know, we haven't recovered. And how many zillions?
Chairman Krupp and Representative Nelson, I would also be curious of that. I think because the way the system is set up, we are pretty much solvent on a regular basis. I mean, my concerns, as yours are as well, throughout the state this year, the limiting factor of general fund contribution to the landowner's fire protection program is weighing heavy on our members at the moment. It's almost like the perfect storm. If you look outside on a March day, it's very dry out. Snowpacks are down. Water levels are down. We could experience fires at any point in time. If you start looking at the backups that we've always relied on the last couple of years with the National Guard, if you're watching the news, they're being dispatched to potential for active duty. We do not have the resources to back us up at the moment. As the districts are trying to lay their plans for establishing their level of protection, this is the time of year traditionally that they've entered into helicopter contracts for severity for the season. With everything hanging in the balance, there's an awful lot of planning that's not taking place at this moment, just waiting to see how things shake out. So as far as how deep are we in the hole, between that and the emergency fire cost insurance, which is still a big unknown, I see the hole in front of us very deep, but I think the hole behind us has been patched and has been moved forward. But I think there's a big hole looming in front of us.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, I'm just concerned. What is this burden for fire insurance? I mean, I'm really, you know, that's the hole. That's the, I mean, that's a big burden.
It is.
And it's increasing, I understand.
We're anxiously waiting for the next meeting of the Emergency Fire Cost Committee, which I believe is the 4th of March. Our representative from Marsh & Associates is supposed to come back with an estimate. We've given him some latitude to scope out a couple of non-traditional policies where there may be some cost sharing within the first level of insurance coverage to help share that burden. But once again, their willingness to insure us is based on our established level of protection.
Okay.
And that's going to fall back to some greater discussions here.
I just want to follow up and say how much I appreciate, you know, your oversight, and I certainly appreciate these men in this department, because what we have is because you've done your job right, and I'm really grateful. And I think we've been miraculously blessed by the responsiveness and training that have prevented more loss of lives, more loss of property, and I just want to thank you all.
Representative Nelson, I appreciate your comments, and it is a very, very highly guarded and appreciated partnership that we have with the Department of Forestry.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Jericho. I have a quick question.
Sure.
On the landowners that you represent, could you define what those are?
Chairman Krupp and Representative Smith, the protection program within OFIC, I do a little bit larger outreach than your traditional OFIC membership. I do represent members that are also not true OFIC members, predominantly in Eastern Oregon. I represent approximately 6 million acres of industrial and non-industrial forest lands within the membership associations of the 12 forest protection districts.
Could you give me a number?
About just under 6 million acres currently.
Of, how many landowners?
It's close to 175 different landowners. That's large industrials as well as a very minimal small woodland owner that avails themselves of my attention.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mike. I appreciate it. And the chair would also like to add his appreciation and understanding of the good work that industry does along with the State Department of Forestry. You really, if we could only have perhaps as much aggressiveness and good policy and management practices on the federal level that we get at the state level, I think our state clearly would not have endured the devastating fire season that we did this last year. And let's hope that the federal government has taken note of that and is in currently taking steps or planning to take steps to rectify that, because it doesn't look good for this coming year. And with that, members, we will await perhaps some clarification with counsel in regards to that one issue. And members, thank you. We are we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2203, and we are adjourned.